You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest, Linwood Barclay, is the author of about 20 thrillers, a memoir, some young adult books and screenplays. He was a newspaper reporter for 30 years or so before he became a best-selling author, and his new book is the highly entertaining Elevator Pitch. Linwood Barclay, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
You know, it's impossible to discuss Elevator Pitch without giving away a lot of the fun secrets of the book. So you give us your elevator pitch for the book. You have 15 seconds.
Well, I can. You
have 10 seconds.
We can talk about it without giving too much away. So the elevator pitch for Elevator Pitch is about a guy who is sabotaging elevators in Manhattan, and they are pitching right down to the bottom of the shaft.
you did it. That's a fantastic pitch. You must have you ever had the occasion of doing an elevator pitch for a book in an elevator?
Not in an elevator. No, I have not. I've made pitches, but never in an actual elevator, as the cliche goes. But I know in the very first chapter of that book, someone is actually doing a pitch in an elevator when things go horribly wrong.
Now, you do kind of manage to maintain a lightness in your storytelling, despite the fact that people get killed and terrible things happen in your book. How do you do that?
I don't know. I think that, you know, for a lot of those years when I was in newspapers, for about 14 or 15 of them, I was a humor columnist. I wrote three sort of satirical or funny columns a week. So I just kind of have a natural inclination to be a little bit sort of off the cuff and a little bit funny. So that always comes through. Sometimes I have to rein it in a bit, and I may do something that's just a little bit too funny, that it doesn't suit the mood, so I'll pull back. But it's just the way I've always kind of written. So it does find its way of sneaking in all the time.
Well, so your books are not like the noirish kind of Raymond Chandler, but I mean, they do have a kind of... Chandler was pretty funny too, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, he could be. And I think a lot of that, the humor in someone like a Chandler and more modern writers like the late Elmore Leonard and so forth, it's not like they're writing funny crime novels, but the dialogue, it crackles, and there's a lot of humor in the dialogue. And I think that's very true of a lot of writers who are writing thrillers and so forth. They still have their dark moments, but humor can have a way of sneaking out in the way people bounce off each other.
So when you were a newspaper reporter, did you have crime stories that were rattling around in your head, or how did you suddenly become a thriller writer?
Well, it wasn't a sudden thing. I was writing stories from about the third grade on, and I was always writing my version of mysteries, whether it was inspired by the Hardy Boys or whether I was writing. I mean, by the age of 10 or 11, I had gotten my dad to teach me how to type so I could write what today we would call fan fiction. And I would write 30 and 40 page novellas based on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or Mission Impossible or, you know, Mannix and stuff like that. So, and then it's my teens and then mid to late teens, nearly 20s, I was writing novels. I was writing crime novels. I was writing thrillers. And I was sending them off to various publishers, and they were sending them back just about as fast as I could send them to them. and I think we can all be grateful that none of those books were published, because they just weren't good enough, even though I had some very nice responses and so forth. So I went into newspapers because I thought, I got my first newspaper job at the age of 22 because I thought, well, where can a guy who likes to write get paid money to write every day? And that was a newspaper. And I might not be writing, you know, some great Chandler-esque novel, but I'd be writing something. So when it finally came back to doing novels later in life, I was really just going back to what I'd always wanted to do.
So you really like writing, you like the chore of writing, of sitting at your computer, I assume. You don't want to use a typewriter, but you like the act of writing?
I do. I think that that just writing itself, I do enjoy it. Sometimes I have to stop and think, am I liking this or not? And I think it's a lot of the peripheral things in writing that are less enjoyable. And, I think the worst part of writing is waiting to hear what your editor thinks of the first draft. To me, that's like waiting for tests to come back from the doctor's office. and that's not writing. Like, you're not, you're just waiting. And to me, that is the worst part of the job in many ways. But the actual writing can be a lot of fun. And so that part I don't mind.
Do you do, or are you the kind of guy that it flows out of you really fast and then you go back and fix it, or do you labor over every sentence?
No, I go pretty fast. I my goal when I, you know, when I'm in the thick of writing a book, my when I'm in the thick of writing a book, my goal is to get 2,000 words done every day. So if you can do that, you've got 10,000 words a week, and in 2.5 months you've got a first draft. So I tend to go very quickly on that process, and I do the sort of serious editing after I have done that. I go back at it and go through it. There are times when I may, you know, I may find I did some work the day before and I realize I went in the wrong direction, and I'll go back. But for the most part, I just plow right ahead. And I think a lot of that has to do, again, with having spent 30 years in newspapers. You know, you're, when you write something for a newspaper, you expect to see it in print within hours. So you don't have the luxury of thinking of sort of agonizing over every sentence. It's like, get it done and get it out of the way.
I guess there's no stupider question than how do you get your ideas. But let me ask you this. How do you get your ideas? I mean, does a simple situation like, say, a tap on the window get a story started in your head?
Yeah, like Tap on the Window is kind of an interesting book because that's where, you know, a fellow picks up a hitchhiker who's a girl who raps on the window of his car and she gets in. And I thought, well, that's a fairly familiar trope of, you know, picking up a hitchhiker. And so I might start with an idea like that, and then I think, well, how can you do something different with it? And so in that particular book, it was, well, what if the girl that you picked up was not the same girl that you dropped off? And somehow a switch happened along the way. And so that's where that came from. And it's, you know, it's sort of a cliche that the question for writers of where do you get your ideas? But I think I can, you know, writers kind of laugh about it when they hear that question. But I can understand it from people who don't do this for a living, because I could sit here and I could think, where did Lennon and McCartney get those ideas? You know, where did Frank Lloyd Wright get those ideas? Because I'm completely in awe of that. How does that happen? So I get that. And but for me, my it's always like a what if comes to me. Like, what if, you know, that hitchhiker turned out to be not the same girl you picked up? Or in the case of my biggest success was a book called No Time for Goodbye. And that was, what if, you know, you're a 14-year-old girl and you get drunk and your parents are mad at you and you go to bed and pass out and you wake up the next morning and the house is empty and everybody's gone, your parents, your brother, and 25 years go by and you've never known what happened. Like, there's a what if. And if I have a what if that I think, you know, or a hook that I think has potential, then I can sit down and start thinking, okay, what set of circumstances created that what if? What actually happened? And once I have a pretty good idea of what it is that happened and who the main characters are and who did what, I can start writing. I can't plan the whole, I don't plan the whole book out. I can't do that. But I have a really good sense of what the whole backstory is, of who's, you know, who's done what. So I'm not sort of, as I'm writing, I'm not thinking, Jim, I wonder if this guy did it or this lady did it. I know who did it because I know where I want to end up. But I don't really know what will happen in the middle of the story. I don't see the opportunities that exist there until I kind of get there.
So do your characters kind of take on a life of their own? They lead you in a certain direction?
The events do, for sure. I mean, I know that there was kind of, Elmore Leonard always just talk about how some character comes in and takes over and just walks off the story. That's never really kind of happened to me. I kind of know what everybody's up to. But I may find along the way that some character starts to emerge as more interesting than I thought he or she might be. And so I can do a little more with them. But I still have kind of a pretty good idea of what everybody's role is and where they're headed.
We're talking to Linwood Barclay, and his new book is called Elevator Pitch, and it's really great. Stephen King and I both like it a lot. Well, a book like Elevator Pitch, it's so intricately plotted and layered, and so there must be a way that you keep track of it all.
Well, I make a few notes when I get started, but I haven't got, you know, a big, huge bulletin board on the wall with post-its and bits of string going from one end of something to another. I don't have anything like that. But I may have a couple of little diagrams in a notebook that is kind of the spokes of the wheel, almost. Everything, what goes back to the center and how are things connected, almost like a family tree. I might do that. But for the most part, the rough idea is in my head, and I don't have to make, I don't have a ton of notes or little cards or post-its. What I really need to do, though, is make a careful note of everybody's name so that I don't start off with a character whose name is George, and on page 100 he becomes Gordon, which I have been known to do that.
And what about in real life? Do you remember people's names well, or do you forget people's names?
You know, it's funny. I'm not as good at that as I used to be. It must be my advancing decrepitude. But, you know, and it's really something when you, like, for example, I was, you know, a couple of days, this past weekend, our daughter got married, and there were a great many people there that I did not know and had not met before. And I thought, there's just no way I'm going to remember anybody's name. What I tended to do was I go up to people and say, hey, didn't we meet before? Because that sort of thing, at least they know that I remember them from somewhere. And then, of course, they all said, nope, haven't met before. But so at least I
nobody
tried.
Said, I'm your first cousin and we grew up together.
At least it didn't get that bad.
Politics are involved in elevator pitch. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you know, after 9/11, there was a lot written about how the lack of law enforcement coordination contributed to the tragedy. And in elevator pitch, you have a crime in which you have basically three different investigators looking at the crime and they don't communicate with each other. Were you thinking of that at all when you wrote the book?
I wasn't thinking of what sort of the what came out of 9/11. I think more that when you're writing a crime novel, and if you're kind of removing from different points of view with different characters, you really don't. I think it's more really a writing device than anything else. I wasn't trying to make a statement, because you want to see different characters putting different parts of the puzzle together. And as a reader, you're waiting for them to kind of intersect and then be able to share what they know, and it's so that you can have a kind of interesting revelation or interesting plot turn, instead of having them all sitting together in the same room and they all know the same thing. So I think it's more like that. But the notion of politics, and I've, a lot of my novels have sort of small-time politics in them. They have mayors and they have various kind of people. Because when I started... as a reporter, I was covering smaller councils and town councils, and it was, I always find those characters really interesting, these sort of big people in little ponds, or big fish in little ponds, who thought they were just, you know, tremendously important, and they were not. And they were, you know, full of egos and self-importance, and I just like sort of pricking the balloon of those kinds of characters.
But at the same time, since you've written a book about tall skyscrapers and bombs, it did feel 9/11-ish in some way.
Yeah, I could see that. And there's a couple of references to it, because there's, of course, once, you know, in terms of the storyline of that book, once the people of New York realize that someone is deliberately sabotaging elevators, and you reach a point where no one knows whether any elevator in the entire city is safe to get into, and you have people who are in tall buildings who kind of have sort of flashbacks to being stuck in tall buildings at a previous time. And so there is a bit of kind of resonance of things that New Yorkers have gone through before without sort of beating anybody over the head with it.
I wonder if you ever think, when you're writing something like this, that you might be giving people ideas. I mean, I guess that's not an author's problem or creator's problem to worry about the nuts out there. But does that ever cross your mind?
Well, not really. Certainly not in this book. I mean, the thing is that's kind of interesting about elevator pitch, that there's a point in the story where an elevator sort of expert is holding a gadget that's like a large TV remote, and he says, with this device, I can control every elevator in this skyscraper and everything that it does. Well, that's a real device. When I was doing some research where I live here in Toronto, in a big skyscraper, this elevator expert took me through, and he showed me this device. And I said, wow, where could you get one of those? And he says, oh, they're on eBay for like $500. And that's when I thought, you know, for a regular person, that might be a bit of alarming news. For me as a thriller writer, I thought, yes, that's terrific because that makes the story more probable. However, as a writer of a thriller like this, I've probably taken a few liberties. And to actually interface that device with the computer, elevator computer system in a particular building is no easy task. And so I think that if anyone were really out to commit mayhem, there are much easier ways to do it than by sabotaging elevators. And one of the main plot points in Elevator Pitch is, why would someone choose this particular method with which to terrify the citizens of New York? What is special about elevators? And that becomes a part of the story as well.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Linwood Barclay. His latest novel is called Elevator Pitch, and it is set in New York City, and I love New York stories, but the idea of not being able to use elevators in New York, what a devastating thing that would be.
Well, that was the whole thing. When I had the idea for this plot, I knew that we couldn't exactly set it, you know, in someplace in Kansas. Like, it was going to have to be a major metropolitan area. And New York, although I don't live there, is a place that I spend an awful lot of time in and go to every year. So I thought, that's a city where I can set this, and I feel I can write about it with a certain degree of confidence that I have seen these, you know, these locales and these places, so I can write it, convince about it convincingly. I mean, a great place to have set a book like this would be Hong Kong. Hong Kong, of course, which is just all of these immense number of really high condo and apartment towers. But I've been there, but I've only been there once, and it was for 3 days, and I thought, I don't know Hong Kong well enough to write about it. But New York always seemed like the most logical place. And, I mean, New York, you have to figure, it's in New York, if you don't live on the 40th floor, you may work on the 40th floor. And New York is a very, very vertical city. I mean, it's got something like 70,000 elevators in it, and if they're not safe to use, what happens in a city like that? How does it cope? Which again becomes part of the story.
Yeah, and it's so hard because I don't want to give anything away in your story.
Can ask me something, and I'll see if we can. If it's something I can tell, whether I'd get any up too much.
Well, the idea that not using an elevator could be just as dangerous as using an elevator.
That's true. That's true. I mean, especially for folks who may be a little older and may have slightly faulty hearts or tickers or whatever, having to take, you know, go 30 floors back up to their residence, that's not going to be a good thing. And if you're, you know, if you do have a bit of a handicap or problem, you don't want to have to come down from the 30th floor. And because, you know, can you go back up? So, again, that becomes an element. There's one little sort of long chapter about two-thirds of the way through the book that are a sort of series of vignettes of different bits of mayhem throughout the city and how people are managing. And I don't even know which version of the novel you may have read. We had advance copies that we sent out to reviewers. And once they were out there and were in, you know, reviewers' hands, I thought, there's not one scene in the novel where two people making out in an elevator run into a problem. I thought, the book has to have that. And so I added another scene of about 2 pages into that one long chapter with all the various incidents of trouble.
A sex scene.
So if you've only read the first version, you're going to want to go back to it.
I'll have to check that out. I haven't read all of your novels. Do you ever use recurring characters, or were any of these characters, will they ever recur? It seems like you've got a good...
Well, these characters are all new. I had never read about any of them before. I think that there are a couple who could come back. We have our two New York detectives. But in particular, I think the main character in this novel is a woman named Barbara Matheson, who is a political journalist, or political columnist for an online site, as opposed to an actual newspaper. And she's a very tough, you know, seasoned journalist who's very good at pointing out the hypocrisy of others and ignoring it in herself. And she's a good character. So she might, you know, I'm not saying she won't come back someday. She might, although I don't have any plans to bring her back right away. In other novels, I mean, the very first 4 books that I wrote that came out between 2004 and 2007 were all about a character named Zach Walker, and they were sort of my four comic thrillers. And so there's, I did those, that series a long time ago. And then in there's the No Time for Goodbye, I did a sequel to that. And then, of course, I've done about, I think, four or five novels that are set in a mythical upstate New York small town called Promise Falls. So a lot of those characters reappear. It's those books are not so much a continuing series with one character as they are a continuing series about a lot of people in this one town. And so, but I think moving forward, my tendency is to kind of do standalones.
Do you, now I know you've written a screenplay, and your book is extremely cinematic, or I don't know if it's cinematic or television-matic, because you know, those two things are so, the line between them is definitely blurred now. But
right.
Do you cast it in your head? Oh, you know.
No. I really don't. I don't cast. I mean, when I'm writing a book, I kind of see it playing out in my head as if it were on a screen. Not because I'm writing for the screen, but that's just how I see it. But I'm not, I don't write and think, oh, this would be a great part for so-and-so. I never do that. I don't really picture who it would be. And a lot of times, readers will suggest, oh, you know, so who would be great as that person would be so-and-so. I think, yeah, they're right. He would be good, you know, or she would be good. But I don't think about it. But I have started sort of dipping my toe into screenwriting. I wrote a novel a few years ago called Never Saw It Coming, which we made into a budget. Or sorry, I was going to say, made on a minimal budget. We made into a movie here in Canada with Eric Roberts in it and Emily Hampshire. And I wrote the screenplay for that. I'm very proud of it. I think it's a great little flick. It's, at the moment, it's only available on a streaming service in Canada. And I've had more opportunities to write screenplay adaptations. But as is often the case in dealing with, you know, Hollywood, just because you've written it doesn't mean it'll ever be seen. And so, you know, a couple of years ago, I spent quite a long time working on a possible six-part TV adaptation of my novel, Trust Your Eyes, and was working with the guy who directed the first Daniel Craig Bond movie, Casino Royale, who had wanted to make that and have me write all the episodes. And, you know, I worked on that for months before the network that was involved finally said, nah, I don't think we'll do it. So you get lots of experience in these things, but it doesn't always happen.
Yeah, that must be frustrating. I mean, at least when you write a novel, you know, it goes out there. People may or may not read it.
That's, out there. That's exactly my point. I would say when you have a book contract, the book comes out. Whereas when you have a contract to do screenwriting projects, who knows? It may or may not. And, of course, the other difference is when you're doing a book, you're working with, you know, generally one, maybe two editors who are weighing in with what they think the book needs. But when you're doing movie stuff, there's no end of people who have an opinion. So it becomes more work by committee, and it tends to move, at least in my experience, moves very, very slowly, because everything just takes forever for anybody to make a decision. I mean, I have written entire novels while just the proposal for a movie, you know, the writing, how the proposal would read was going back and forth. So it's a different kind of world.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, you mentioned the Hardy Boys in passing, and I know you've written some young adult stuff, too.
Yeah, I did two books for younger readers, a book called Chase and the sequel called Escape. And I did those because I woke up at 2 in the morning, and I had this idea in my head that was pretty much fully formed, which was about a dog that was being implanted with all sorts of software so that it could be used for surveillance purposes, because if you send a dog into some sort of hostile environment, nobody pays attention to it. But what if this dog could record things and knew how to and understood speech and so forth? And so, and this particular dog is not working out, that its canine instincts keep overruling its software, and it would still rather chase a squirrel than chase a spy. And so this institute that is, you know, putting this dog into action decides they're going to have to put the dog down. But the dog is smart enough to know that's coming and escapes. And once having escaped, the dog is on a mission to find one very specific boy, and we don't know why.
Is his name Timmy?
Pardon?
Is his name Timmy?
Timmy? No, he's not. He's not Timmy. But this dog has to find this boy. And so I wrote, and the first book, the second book starts about within days after the end of the first one, so it's really a two-parter. But the thing was, I had this idea, and it was such a great idea, and I knew that it wasn't really, didn't really work as one of my adult thrillers. So I thought, well, it's too good not to write. And my wife, who is a retired kindergarten teacher, said, you have to write this book. She said, boys and girls will love this book, but boys who are reluctant readers will especially love this book, and you need to write it. And so I did. And so I did those two, but at the moment I'm not anticipating doing any more because I have found that doing, you know, one major adult thriller per year and the odd the screenplay work is as much as I can handle in a given year. And I didn't want to take on doing, you know, like a novel for kids every year as well because I can't do it all.
And yet there are a lot of Linwood Barclay novels out there. You've written a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, this, I think, Elevator Pitch, I believe, is the 19th novel. So, I mean, given that the first one came out in 2004, it's clear that there's been almost one a year, almost every year there's been one, and some years there have been two. So, it's been busy.
Now, you just completed a book tour, so you've met with your fans. What's that like?
Oh, well, that's always really nice. I mean, you know, we had it was quite a long tour because it started in the UK. Actually, we started in Dublin, went to Belfast, then it was down in London for a few days, then it was up in Edinburgh and Glasgow. And the UK, as it turns out, is my biggest market. My books do well in a lot of places, but they do better there than anywhere. And I was on that tour for 2 weeks, and then I was home for all of 36 hours in Toronto and then embarked on a 5-day U.S. tour. So, but tours are nice because, not in every respect, because they can be quite exhausting. But writing is a very solitary occupation. I mean, even when you work in a newsroom, at least you have your comrades who can come over and say, hey, that was a good story, or you really blew it on that one, or whatever. You talk to people. But when you're writing novels, you're very much on your own. And social media does allow feedback in ways that you never used to be able to get at. But it's nice to actually see people, you know, face to face who are reading your books. And you realize they really are out there. There are people reading these books.
Yeah, no, we read them. We read them. And we review them. What about that? You know, the Amazon reviews. Do you read those?
I take a look at them. I mean, the one-star ones. Used to really bother me, and now I just mostly find them kind of amusing. I mean, someone gave one of my kids' books a one-star review because they thought it was one of my adult books. So they made a mistake, but they didn't like it because it was a kid's book, so it gets one star. Or your novel gets one star because it arrived late. And one time I looked and I saw this guy had given me two stars for some book and had said all these bad things about it. And I thought, geez, I wonder what he's saying of other authors. Maybe he hates everyone. And then I looked and saw that the only other thing that he had reviewed was a cordless vacuum, but that had gotten one star. So I felt good that my novel was better than that cordless vacuum.
Why do your books have different covers in England than they do over here?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And I think it's kind of, that and Where Elephants Go to Die are two of the biggest mysteries in the world. You know, first of all, I have different publishers in different markets. So, not in all cases, but in fact, I do have HarperCollins is basically my publisher in both the U.S. and in the U.K. But every country or every region kind of has its own sensibility in how they do things. And I think just right across the board, you'll find that covers in the UK are different than covers in the United States. And I think part of it is, I think that they tend to be more subtle, a little bit more held back. And I think that they just know what their market likes. And, you know, I mean, the kind of cars they drive is different. I mean, so many things that they do, you know, that are different between those two places. And one of them is just books. They just have their own sense of what they think works. They have their own art department. And once in a while, we'll have a kind of an agreement. Like when I did a book last year called The Noise Downstairs, the UK and the US covers were very close to identical because we had a really nice idea for an image. But the elevator pitch covers are completely different between the US and the UK. Not really, they just want to do their own thing, you know?
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro here on KSCO, and my guest this week is the New York Times bestselling author Linwood Barclay, whose novels include No Time for Goodbye, Never Saw It Coming, The Accident, A Tap on the Window, A Noise Downstairs, and his latest book, Elevator Pitch. I think people who love your books would be interested in knowing what kinds of things you love, what books you read, what shows you watch, what movies you've seen.
Yeah, I watch a lot of stuff and read a lot of stuff. I tend to, when it comes to reading, I like to read people who are better at this than I am. So the list is long, and you know, I mean, I'm just looking at what on the pile of things I've read lately, and there's Don Winslow's The Border and the latest James Lee Burke. And, you know, people who are really, I don't necessarily even read a lot of the exact same kind of thing that I write. I mean, I just read recently that huge biography on Mel Brooks and Richard Russo's latest. And he's, you know, more a literary than a genre writer. And so I kind of mix it up a bit. And as far as TV goes, I mean, it's funny, we'd love to sink our teeth into some kind of series that's great to binge. And we haven't found one lately. We keep debating whether to watch Chernobyl. I keep trying to convince my wife that it might be really funny, but she's not.
Oh, it's hilarious.
That's what I thought. I thought, how could it not be? And but we know, we just thought, did we have to watch one more thing that's incredibly grim? But, you know, grim is interesting. And whether it's the UK series Bodyguard or Ozark, or, you know, any number of things like these, you know, there's some very good stuff out there. And you know, it's funny, often I'm in charge of what are we going to watch next? What great series have you found for us? And I have to, sometimes I just sort of throw up my hands and I said, I think we've seen everything that's ever been made. And although that's not quite true.
The Beverly Hillbillies is good.
I know. You know, I like watching some of the old 60s stuff, but it's usually the dramas like Mission Impossible, things like that. I love watching those old
shows. You mentioned The Man from U.N.C.L.E. That's one of my favorites.
And The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is my all-time favorite. You know, I credit this. I mean, you might find this interesting. People often ask, well, what made you want to write? And I think more than anything, as a kid, it was that particular show. Because I found that I loved that show so much. I mean, that show debuted, I think, when I was 9 years old. And I'll give you a moment to do the math. But anyway, I was 9 when that came on, and that I love that show so much that an episode a week just was not enough for me. I had to have more, so I would write my own stories with those characters, you know, as what we would today call fan fiction. And I probably wrote 6 or 7 or more 30, 40-page double-spaced novellas based on that show. I was just cranking them out. So that show, more than anything else, is what got me fired up about writing. It wasn't reading the Hardy Boys. It wasn't reading Agatha Christie or even Nero Wolfe, the Nero Wolfe books, which I think I discovered around when I was in grade 6. I discovered the Nero Wolfe novels by Rex Stout. But it was TV that got me really fired up. And I think in my teens, my mid-teens, that by then I think it was Columbo that was my favorite show for a long time. And when in my mid-late teens, I thought what I wanted to do with my life was to be a TV screenwriter, although there was very low demand for that in rural Ontario where I was living. You know, it was mostly dairy country and tourism, so they didn't have a big demand for screenwriters. I can remember going down to the guidance office one day at high school, and they had a binder that was like two times the size of a New York phone book. And it supposedly listed every single possible career choice for, you know, these high school students. So I would open it up and look for screenwriter, novelist, TV writer. And all I could find was dairy farmer, screen door repairman. You know, I couldn't find that in there. Anyway.
It's funny that you mentioned, I assume you've binged Mad Men.
Oh, of course. Oh, God. I think Mad Men is that's literature on television.
I agree. And Sally Draper, the little girl, she's the exact same age as you and me. That is, she was born when the show starts.
Right.
She's five. So,
yep.
And she has a moment with the man from Uncle. That's
I do remember.
That's really watching, interesting.
She's watching David McCollum, who played Ilya Kuryakin, and had provided something of an awakening for her.
That's
and,
right.
I think that Mad Men is sort of one of those things you watch it and you think, this is literature on television. That was the show every week I couldn't wait. And you know, a lot of times not a lot happened in an episode of Mad Men, but it didn't matter. It was all about subtleties and nuances. It's just such a great show.
I agree. And of course I also love Columbo. I think, you know, now I think in your spare time, Linwood Barclay, you could write a great Columbo.
You know, I watched the Columbo I rewatched the Columbo earlier this week, the one where Patrick McGoohan plays the commander or whatever of a
By Dawn's Early Light.
By Dawn's Early Light. It's just so good. I mean, and that one won Patrick McGoohan an Emmy for guest appearance. It's such a great episode. My favorite Columbo episodes tend to be the ones with the best last 5 minutes, where, you know, the way that he nails them is just so clever, and just haven't seen that one coming. Those are my favorites. I mean, I've been even like the Spielberg episode that the Steven Spielberg directed one. I think it's called what's that one called? It's Publisher Parish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
Jack Cassidy.
And it's a Reed Martin Milner, and it's a really really good episode, and it's beautifully shot, and you see all these little touches that Spielberg later brought to his movies, but it doesn't have a Sacco ending. Like, it doesn't have, you know, that little final moment when you've got the clue that's supposed to nail him. To me, it's not very solid. So, despite everything else in that one being so good, that one moment, that one doesn't do it for me.
I think my favorite is A Stitch in Crime with Leonard Nimoy as a doctor.
I love that one, too. I think that one is a terrific one. It's really one of my favorites.
I like how the best Columbos, they just end. I mean, once it's over, once the mystery is solved, the credits play. There's no after play.
There's another great one I love, I think, from the early days, and that's it's the one with the chess master who has a hearing problem.
Oh, yes, Lawrence Harvey.
Lawrence Harvey, that's a really good one. And one that people don't seem to rave much about, but had, I think it's Roddy McDowell, it's called Short Fuse, and has to do with an exploding cigar box.
I love that one, yeah. They're on
the episode is kind of okay, but it has this spectacular ending in that sort of cable car over that goes up the top of a mountain, and Columbo has found the cigar box that is supposedly the one with the bomb in it, and it didn't go off, and McDowell's in the cable car, and he believes that's the bomb. It's fantastic ending. William Wyndham's in there, too.
William Wyndham. I love him.
Yeah, he was driven. So I always measure Columbo by that last 5 minutes.
It's, you and I are both Columbo fans.
Oh yeah. It's just such a great show. It was good because it turned the formula upside down. You found out right at the opening. You knew who did it. The mystery was, how will he get them? How will Columbo solve it? And so it took the whole notion of what a mystery was about and turned it upside down. And then, of course, it had the best, most spectacular TV detective ever in Peter Falk. So it's just a brilliant show.
And the idea that Peter Falk, you know, pretends to be something less than he is.
Yes. Yeah, he presents himself as sort of a bumbler. And, of course, I think I read a piece on this recently that's very much what Columbo was about. This is about class. Because he appears to be, you know, down and out and from a lower socioeconomic class and a bumbler. And all of his adversaries are elitist, generally rich people who look down their nose at him. And so it's wonderful in that way. I mean, there's a lot of levels to Columbo if you start thinking about it. So it's really one of the best TV shows ever made.
I agree, and I think one of the secrets of its success was that it wasn't on every week.
No, it was part of that rotating wheel with McLeod and all these other things. So you only had about maybe six episodes a season, if that. And then they did a few. Then there was a huge gap where they didn't do any for quite a few years, and they came back in like the late 80s, early 90s, did some more episodes. Most of them are not very good.
Although Patrick McGoohan was in one of them.
That's a good one. That's a good one. And there's one, I can't remember the name of the actor, but he's sort of like a young Spielberg. He's a movie maker.
Oh, yeah, it's Fisher Stevens, I believe.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Steve Fisher. And that's a very good one. It's quite stylistic. It's well done. But some of them are real turkeys. And a couple times they decided to vary the formula and not follow the Columbo formula. Those episodes are just unwatchable.
There's one of the original Columbos. I can't believe how much time we're spending on Columbo, people. But cool. There's one of the original Columbos that varies the formula, and that one was directed by Patrick McGoohan.
That's the one that on the boat or the ship or whatever.
Yeah.
The Commodore or something. Farewell.
That's
to
right.
The Commodore.
Last salute to the Commodore. That's the one.
That's right. Yeah, that's considered by most to be a turkey. Yeah, it's not a good one. It's not one of the ones they review. I have most of the Columbo's on DVD, and that's where I'll pick one out and watch one. But that's not one I ever bother with.
You mentioned doing some research when you're writing your book, and there's a character in Elevator Pitch who has trouble breathing, and I wonder if that's based on fact.
It's kind of an invention. I felt that, you know, this cop has suffering from a bit of post-traumatic stress disorder, and what happens to him when he is stressed out is he becomes short of breath, and so he uses a little asthma inhaler to open up his lungs when he gets that way. And I did a little bit of research to see if that was a common affliction, and I didn't find necessarily a lot to support it. But what I do know is that when my father died, when I was 16 years old, which was a pretty traumatic time for me, I would wake up in the night and I was short of breath. And I thought, that's good enough for me. And so I thought, that's what I'm going to have happen to this cop, is that in moments of stress, he starts wheezing like a tea kettle and he needs help, which leads to, I think, a pretty cool scene very late in the novel when he most needs his inhaler. And I couldn't wait to get to that scene.
Are you halfway through your next novel? Where are you in your next
novel? Well, it's sort of a funny thing about that. So I'd actually, you know, you tend to deliver a book to your publisher about the time the book comes out, certainly if you're on an annual schedule. And I had delivered a book that was a little bit more like a Michael Crichton thriller. And everybody liked it, but they thought, this is a bit different than what you typically do, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? And then I happened to mention what I was going to write next. And my editors in both the U.S. and U.K. went, oh, my God, that is such a great idea. We'll wait. So I have written one word of that book. It'll mean that my next book comes out. And like, we're still going to do this other book at some point. But they felt that Elevator Pitch was a very strong novel, and they wanted to follow it with something that was as, you know, good as a knockout. So I think I'm going to do this other one. So instead of coming out with another book, say, next fall, you might bring it out January of 2021, give us the time for that. And what's curious is that my understanding is that a lot of publishers and a lot of novelists are not excited about having their book come out next fall because, you know, unless the current president is impeached and is gone, next fall promises to be a circus, and it's going to be very hard to get attention for anything. Nobody wants to be coming out with a novel in October of next year because all the oxygen will be sucked out of the room by what's happening in current events. So if I can delay a book until the very first of 2021, provided that the planet is still here, I think that might be a good time to come out with a book.
Well, I'm going to say it'll still be here then. But
yes, I mean, it's hard to say what shape it will be in, but it'll probably be around.
Well, this book is called Elevator Pitch, and the author, my guest, Linwood Barclay. Thank you so much for spending some time with me on From the Bookshelf.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks very much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.